Tim Watkins, Steve McCabe. Hello, Steve.
Good afternoon, Jim.
On the panel today, more on a living wage. Why should charter schools not be scrutinised under the Official Information Act? Should local councils be able to stop prostitutes congregating on streets? What Dick Smith said about New Zealanders. A little bit about Valentine's Day again. Richard Prosser again, too. All on the panel with Steve and Tim between 4 and 5. But Susan Baldacci is here to talk about what the world's talking about.
Well, if you've ever been to the Louvre to see the Mona Lisa, you might want to ask for your money back. There, I think we talked about this a few months ago, just before the end of last year. This foundation that has a Mona Lisa and says that this is actually, Leonardo da Vinci painted this one first,
yeah,
before the one hanging in the Louvre. This is an original, and you guys just all have to believe it. And, of course, everyone went, yeah, don't think so. Well, new tests say that, yes, in fact, it was painted before the Mona Lisa that's hanging in the Louvre. They've done these a couple of different things. One is with geometry, looking at the angle of the brush strokes and so forth that Leonardo da Vinci did in the way he approached his paintings. And this is from the Swiss Federal Institute of Technology. And they say, yes, this new Mona Lisa was painted before the one that's hanging in the Louvre. And also tests were conducted, carbon dating the canvas and the painting and everything. And yes, it was manufactured between 1410 and 1455. So more and more evidence is starting to stack up that this second Mona Lisa is the real deal.
Okay, so La Gioconda, the famous one, was the one he did second. Why?
Well, so documents show that he painted this wife, this portrait of Lisa for that gentleman, that yeah. Leonardo da Vinci did that. And then he probably gave it to him, which is the one that is the sort of the new one.
Yeah.
And then left Italy and took up residence in France. And then he did the Mona Lisa again when he was in France.
Okay.
And that's the one that's hanging in the Louvre.
You're right. It has been speculated on endlessly, hasn't it? So these are reputable tests,
so
obviously.
So now reputable tests, reputable agencies, and I just don't think anyone's ever going to completely buy it until...
Well, they can buy it if they want, but this is a Mona Lisa. The one in the Louvre is the Mona Lisa.
And it always... just gets on the Louvre.
Well, it's the standard one, isn't it? I mean, I'm reminded of Monty Python and the Holy Grail here, where you've got Graham Chapman as the English king outside the Frenchman's castle. He's saying, we are searching for the Holy Grail. And he says, we've already got one. there can only be one.
Well, if you see them side by side, it's very hard to tell the difference, except one has shown, looks like it's a bit worn with time. But I actually think the so-called new one, the one that they're presenting now, is slightly better.
Does she look older in one of them?
She does. She looks older on the one that's been in the Louvre, and that was painted second. 10 years can really take its toll on a woman. Now, Jeremy Paxman, the host of Newsnight and University Challenge, is being called a bully over his treatment of a contestant who got one of his questions wrong.
10 points for this. The liberties of England and the Protestant religion I will maintain. Which royal figure made that claim?
Banker Pierce!
I was going to Elizabeth I, but no.
I'm afraid you lose 5 points. When he landed at Brixham in Devon in 1688.
Hugh Tushchuk Smith.
William the First.
No! William the First. No, I'm sorry, that's the wrong answer. You know it's very wrong. It's only up by about 600 years or so. Anyway, there's William of Orange, of course, William the Third.
Yeah, I mean, I think the kid actually kind of knew. But just, jumped in.
Yeah, well, he would be nervous and everything. The problem was that this poor, poor boy kept his head down for the rest of the game. Though his team did go on to win, which is good. But, the Twitterverse is calling Paxman a bully and all sorts.
It's Jeremy Paxman. That's his shtick. It's what he's done for years.
That's what the BBC
It's his shtick in current affairs when he does those interviews. But it's not the shtick on University Challenge.
Well, that, to be fair, was fairly mild. I give my kids at school worse than that.
Are you a tyrant?
But you're not on national television.
Are you a tyrant in the classroom?
Sometimes.
Okay.
Only when they deserve it.
So, you wouldn't present a lacerating tongue like that to your lovely little charges, would you?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah, but it's not on national television where he's going to be embarrassed in front of all and sundry. That's the problem.
To be fair though, it wasn't that bad. I mean, William the First is a fairly important name in British history.
Yeah, but to say, oh, come on, and you're out by 600 years, you don't have to say that. You just have to say, actually, you're wrong.
That's right. Yeah.
Any other questions?
You both do. You're too soft. You're too kind, the pair of you.
Yeah, we are. We're too nice.
Okay, well, it's going to take University Challenge to figure out what's in your burger these days if you're eating burgers in Britain. And, you know, there's the big scandal. I'm sure you've heard about specialty meat suppliers or have seen this. But specialty meat suppliers are seeing an actual surge in people wanting horse burgers. Horse burger meat apparently very much in vogue now that everybody's eating it in their lasagna. They want to actually eat horse burgers. So they've seen customers coming up and asking for it. A tenfold increase in the sale of horse meat.
It's just publicity, isn't it? It's marvelous what publicity will do.
And it's awfully tasty. Why not?
Have you had horse meat?
Oh, yeah.
What, in Britain, on a burger?
Not okay, in Britain, not that I know of. When I was in Japan, I used to eat it raw, basashi.
What?
Yes.
Good Lord.
Surprisingly tasty.
Well, some of these exotic food suppliers...
Basashi.
Basashi.
Some of these exotic food suppliers are saying, you wouldn't believe what people are asking for. They want zebra, llama, alpaca, kangaroo, crocodile. They just want all sorts of different things. Frankly, I think I'd rather eat horse meat than some of the other stuff that I suspect is in some people's burgers who will not be named.
There's a joke about the zebra, people getting mixed up because of the barcode and thinking it. There are a number of jokes. Justin here had one. Why do the British use so much cheese in their beef lasagna? To mascarpone. Our listeners have many, and my favourite is a cow walks into a bar and the barman says, why the long face? Anyway,
well,
I interrupted
listen,
you.
For years, I've not been allowed to donate blood because they said that we've been eating mad cow-tainted beef. It turns out we've not been eating beef at all. So they're going to test me for mad horse?
Yeah, mad horse disease. Yeah.
There isn't a mad horse disease, is there?
No, I don't think so.
I know.
Now, this sounds to me just as romantic as maybe touring an abattoir for Valentine's Day. But in New York, the big thing to do on Valentine's Day is tours of the Newtown Creek sewage treatment plant.
The sewage tour.
Yes, it is. It's a biggie. They only do tours a couple of times a year. Valentine's Day is always one of them.
Yeah.
And they fill quickly. Everybody wants to go
what,
and
the
see.
The sewers fill quickly?
The tours of the sewers fill quickly. Highlights include the plants. They have this like giant egg-shaped digester. It breaks down noxious waste into harmless sludge and gas. Always romantic on Valentine's Day. So,
are you intrigued about what happens down there? And would you take your beloved on a sewer tour?
No and no in that order.
Okay, then. There's a certain fascination with it, though. But I mean, you'd have to endure the smell.
Oh, you'd have to endure the smell, but...
It's New York. How could it smell any worse?
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah,
it probably does smell slightly worse.
Yes,
that'd be my thinking.
I know. It is amazing, but I'm sure it's very fascinating because it is amazing. I know when I lived in London, you used to think that what you're drinking has been recycled several times.
Oh, yeah.
And to get your head around that,
I don't like thinking about that.
We don't want to talk about that.
No.
Now, what we do want to talk about is the office affair, the office romance. Nearly 30% of workers have dated someone in the office at one point or another. 16% have said they've dated their boss.
16%.
And women are significantly more likely than their male peers to date someone higher up in their organization. So, but there are some specific industries where office romances actually tend to happen more often than others.
Yeah.
I think these are predictable. Leisure and hospitality. You work long hours. You work sort of out of hours. The only people you can date are the people you work with because you all work weekends and nights.
Yeah, that's all you see.
Information technology tend to sort of intermingle,
yeah.
Apparently.
Okay. Anything else?
Financial sector, healthcare, and professional and business services, which pretty much covers everything, I think.
Yes, not a lot. If 16% of workers date their bosses, good afternoon, Tim Watkin.
Good afternoon, Jim Mora.
If 16% of workers date their bosses, then you've got to work out the stats on that, and that would suggest that just about every boss is dating someone who works under them. Because that's a lot of workers dating bosses, isn't it?
16%? Yeah. I guess it depends on how many bosses. I mean, there's some organizations where
they have lots
there's
of bosses.
Lots of chiefs and lots of Indians.
Yeah,
so.
Are we talking middle management?
Yeah, that's right. What do you mean by boss? Yeah. Not everybody's dating the...
Well, Deb and I used to run a business from home, and she was definitely the boss, so does that count?
Yeah, that's probably in the statistics, so we'll take that one.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, so, you know, we all love a good apocalypse. The last one on December 21st kind of... fizzed.
That was a letdown, wasn't it?
Yeah, there you go.
Come on, it's not.
No, don't worry.
Well, there's a new one to look forward to. There's a new one to look forward to. The
it's
papal,
like a London bus, isn't
it's
it?
The papal apocalypse. Doomsday fanatics say that the next pontiff will be the last, and this is according to the 12th century prophecy of the popes. And all the signs are pointing to this because there were apparently, at this time that this was written all, you know, hundreds of years ago, 112 cryptic phrases were used to describe different popes. Pope John Paul was linked to one of the leading up to the apocalypse as being from the labor of the sun. And as it turns out, Pope John Paul was born in a solar eclipse, died in a solar eclipse.
Oh,
must be a sign.
My goodness.
And now Benedict is, he's the glory of the olive.
The glory of the olive.
His prophecy.
Is that what you associate with Pope Benedict's reign, the glory of the olive?
Glory of olive. Do the
no, there are many things I associate with his reign, but that's not one of them.
These are the prophecies of St. Malachi, aren't they?
Yes, yes, that's okay. Right. And this was, you know, he traveled to Rome in 1139, all those years ago, wrote all of these down, all these cryptic phrases that are supposed to happen in a series and then lead to the apocalypse. And apparently Benedict and some of the of his order members are known as Olivetans. So that's obviously a sign. I think that's got to be a sign.
No, you've got to convince
maybe
where we're going with this one.
Maybe he just likes olive oil.
And
so.
Can we just point out, you know, these people are all Christian. And they're all talking to a Christian apocalypse. And Jesus made it perfectly clear in the Gospels that no man knows the day of his return. Okay. It's very clear that you can't predict this. But they reckon, oh, I reckon Jesus was wrong and I can.
Under his breath, he said, except St. Malachi.
Clear. Yeah, right.
And Nostradamus and the Mayans and the Da Vinci.
Yeah. And Harold Camping.
Yeah, apart from those guys, nobody can.
There's a long history of people getting it wrong. Oh, you know, Christopher Columbus and Sir Isaac Newton, Martin Luther, they all think they...
Don't you believe in gravity?
Well, he got that one right. He just
you don't think
a little
he
bit off
the
on the
world,
apocalypse thing.
Columbus didn't even know which continent he was on.
No, that's right. Now, Facebook has a little bit of a problem. They're being sued for the use of the like button. And this is a Dutch programmer who says that he patented that 5 years before Facebook's launch. Now, this inventor, programmer has passed away, but the patent holder, his company, Rembrandt Social Media, is seeking legal action against Facebook.
What did he have a like button for?
He had something called the Surfbook, which is a social diary. And so users were allowed to look at each other's content and like it.
Oh, Surfbook before Facebook.
Surfbook before
Never
Facebook.
Never heard of Surfbook.
Why now? It's not
I
like
know,
Facebook
doing...
has just arrived and they spotted it.
Maybe because it's gone public now. I don't know what the timing is about there.
Maybe in Holland it's just arrived. You know, they take the time to catch
Surfbook with
Surfbook.
Like buttons. How interesting.
Yeah, no.
Okay. So and Apple's...
Apple's got issues too. So in Brazil, according to authorities, they've released a ruling that a company there actually came up with the name iPhone before Apple did. And so what this means is that Apple can't claim to, you know, use the iPhone trademark in Brazil. It's not going to stop them from using it anywhere else, but it'll stop them in Brazil. But it must be hard when you're an inventor or you're somebody trying to come up with a new idea. You can't check every single patent office in every single country around the
world.
What
it tells you, there's nothing new under the sun, Horatio.
Right.
And it's not the first time Apple have fallen foul of this. When they announced the Apple TV device a few years ago, and they actually unveiled it, they're doing what the iTV. And there's an entire TV network in the UK that said, I don't think so.
But there was a Brazilian iPhone, although they weren't actually making the phone, but they patented
the
name.
Patented
and
the
now
name.
They're making the phone.
And now, well why wouldn't you?
Here I suggest in Brazil they could call it the iCarumba.
Uh-huh.
No, you may not suggest.
Uh-huh.
No.
Uh-huh.
Tim Watkins, Steve McCabe, Susan Baldacci, thank you very much. The panel shortly.